coming in gold and a world record. Ian Thorpe,
the birth of a legend.
458 is the total, out of which Bradman has made 309 not out. It's a world's record.
Ball in Test cricket in England for Shane Warne. And he's done it. He started off with the most beautiful delivery. Yes!
Australia have got it! Yes! Australia is back on the biggest stage.
Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Here's your host, Sam Edmund.
Everybody, and welcome to the show, powered as always by our friends at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Today, we're joined by Australia's greatest major golfing champion. Kari Webb's relentless pursuit of excellence has seen her claim 7 majors and win 41 times on the LPGA Tour, where she is the second highest earner in history. A member of the Golf World Hall of Fame and an officer of the Order of Australia, Kari has been a magnificent ambassador for her country since she started turning heads in the early 1990s. But now, she's just as driven to make the golfing and sporting worlds a fairer and better place for those who follow her. Kari Webb, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Where do we find you at the moment?
I'm actually home in North Queensland in Townsville.
You just had your first weekend behind the mic, though, haven't you? The weekend before last at the Athena down in Coolangatta.
Yes, I did. Yeah, it was a new experience for me, but it was a lot of fun.
And that was we could speak for a while about that tournament. It was obviously the aim of it was to showcase the next generation of Australian female golfers, which something close to your heart, which we'll come back to. But how did you actually find the art of appearing on the other side of the camera, so to speak? Where did it rank on the nervousness scales compared to standing over the first tee?
I got a little nervous in the days leading up, and we had a dress rehearsal on the Friday for the Saturday telecast because no one had ever televised a skills event live before. So that was really good for me to get, learn the ropes without being live on TV. That sort of calmed the nerves a little bit, and we had a few technical issues, but other than that, I think it went all right.
You, Kari, you grew up about 1,500 kilometres north of there, the eldest of 3 girls, the small hamlet of Ayre. So for those unfamiliar, that's obviously North Queensland, about, 90 k's south of Townsville, sugarcane territory. What are your memories of childhood?
Back then, the Burdekin, which is the whole district, was a really thriving small farming community. And we had the best of everything as far as sport goes. You know, we had great sporting venues for anything, soccer fields, football fields, and even our golf course. For a country course was, even when we'd have the pros come through in the Tropo Tour circuit, it was one of the best country courses they played. So for me growing up, I didn't feel like I... as far as my golf development goes, I don't feel like I missed out on anything because, I could walk to the golf course and, I was out there as much as I wanted to be.
Oh, it sounds like a great place to grow up. And your mum and dad, Evelyn and Rob, they still run the old movie theatre in town, Kari?
Yeah, they're still managing that for us. And my dad just turned 70, so we're looking for an exit plan at the moment. But, that's been 20 years. Last year was our 20th anniversary of owning it and having it, run movies for everyone in town.
That's great, isn't it? Because this was, I think, built in 1909, but of course it had changed hands. It had turned into a restaurant, I think, maybe even a clothing store for a time until you bought it for your folks, I guess, primarily. And what was it, 2000 then it must have been. Nice to do something for your parents, I imagine.
Yeah, my dad was a builder, had his own company, but in a small town, you're actually doing the physical labor as well. And he just decided, heading into his 50th birthday, that it was getting too physically taxing to be on a roof in the middle of January, February heat. And he was looking for a change, and he came up with the idea and found the building and you know, away we went. We got the building at auction, and then that was his last construction job, and we opened December of 2000.
Seen a few flicks in there, have you?
Yeah, I have actually. I was stuck over in the States for most of last year with COVID, and you know, it was great to come home and go to the movies and you know, just do something that, you know, you weren't able to do, you know, for more than 12 months. So yeah, it was great.
You mentioned your dad obviously ran his own building company. I think your mum worked in a toy shop in town there. What sort of work ethic though did they instill in a young Kari Webb, do you think?
Yeah, they were both really hard workers. You know, my dad worked, especially if he was busy, he'd work 6 days a week. And, you know, mum, she did work for her parents in the toy shop and gift store. But then later on, she bought a lunchtime fish and chip shop, which actually was my first job out of high school, was working there. But, yeah, no, they were very hard workers. And, you know, and it was also, you know, hard work, but, you know, played hard on the weekends and always had a nice social life. And, you know, a lot of my good friends now are the friends I made through my parents' friends and the barbecues and everything that they'd have.
Fantastic. So take us, Kari, through your relationship with the game that's obviously shaped your life. I mean, your parents and grandparents, from what I understand, took up the game around the time you were born. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they were just sort of taking up the game, I think just before I was born. And so all four of them were really avid golfers. So, you know, my earliest memories were really, so my grandparents had the two businesses, and so they worked 6 days a week, and my parents would dump us off at their place Saturday afternoon, and my grandma would look after us, and my grandfather and both my parents would play Saturday afternoon, and she would bring us out about 5 o'clock, and, you know, all the parents were upstairs having a drink, and all the kids. It was a relatively young club. There was tons of kids my age out there, and we'd just run amok downstairs, running through bunkers and all sorts of things. But you know, it was just the great atmosphere. You know, and being the eldest child, I think I just wanted to do what mum and dad did, and so that's sort of what led me to golf.
Yeah, it's amazing because we are all products of our environment, aren't we, at the end of the day? And I guess we've all had the set of plastic clubs, and you were no different. I think you'd play with them on Sunday mornings with your grandparents for a time.
Yeah, so then, yeah, my grandparents, so they're one day off, they'd get up at the crack on a Sunday morning, and then at the age of four, they started picking me up because I had gotten a set of plastic clubs for Christmas, and they'd take me around for nine holes with them. And at four, I, you know, couldn't walk the full nine holes. So my granddad was pulling his bag with me on the back of it for most of the nine holes. But yeah, that's my earliest memory of actually playing golf, was with the two of them.
That's great. And then I think it's well documented, but you're around 8 years of age when you got your first set of cut down clubs. And then I think in the years thereafter, you speak about how great it was growing up in Ayr. You'd make the 5 minute walk to the club from home, and I think you'd typically stay there hitting until it was dark. I mean, what was fueling you at this point, Kari? I mean, must just have been pure enjoyment and love of the game.
Yeah, I did. I just took to the game and played a ton of other sport, but, you know, golf was always the one for me. I think I just liked the fact that I didn't have to rely on anyone else. Like, I played some team sports, and, you know, I hated if someone wasn't as good, or, you know, if I was playing cricket or softball or anything like that, someone couldn't throw very well or catch very well or hit. You know, I just like the fact that it was all down to me, I think. And the time I put in, I got the rewards from. So, you know, I think that's what ultimately drew me to it. But I attended my grandparents. So my birthday is close to Christmas. And so for my 12th birthday, it was an early present, but they paid for me to go down to see the 1986 Queensland Open at Quillengetta Tweed, where we were last weekend.
Greg Norman.
Yeah, to watch Greg Norman. That was the first ever professional event I'd been to. And I just loved it, loved the atmosphere. I loved that, you know, people came out to watch other people play golf. And, you know, I came home, so I wasn't quite 12 yet, and came home and told my parents that that's what I wanted to be when I grew up. So from then on, it was really just me wanting to, achieve that goal. And you know, my parents never once told me that's not something I couldn't do. You know, my mum tells plenty of stories where the adults would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I'd say a professional golfer. And then their comments to my parents were, "You're not going to let her believe she can do that, are you? Like, you know, she's got to have a more sensible plan than playing professional golf." But my parents never were like that. I mean, as long as I kept my grades up at school, they didn't care how much time I put into golf, as long as, you know, that school was still ticking along well. So, and they never pushed me. So if I had come home, you know, at 16 and said, I don't want to play golf anymore, as long as it wasn't a stupid reason, you know, like, you know, the kids at school don't think it's cool or whatever. As long as it wasn't a reason like that, they would have supported that as well. So, they just were very supportive and allowed me to put my own time in and work hard to achieve my goals.
Gee, that's great, isn't it? And just coming back to that environment, that community that you grew up in, Carrie, I guess at Ayr Golf Club as a kid after school, there were no tea times. There were few days or times at a country club where kids couldn't play. Do you ever wonder or think you'd have had the career you did if you grew up in a major city, or how different it might have been?
Yeah, definitely would have been different. And it would have perhaps led me to take other sports up more seriously, perhaps. The culture at the Ayr Golf Club was, you know, they needed every member they could get. And they were very encouraging to kids, because they knew that was the future of the club. I could be out. Well, my high school backed up to the golf course, which was good and bad, but it was good because I could walk there after school, but I couldn't skip school because they could see me. So,
you didn't ever do that, did you, Carrie?
No, I didn't. I missed enough in grade 11 and 12. I missed enough school going away, to tournaments that I couldn't afford to skip anymore anyway. So, I lost track of what I was going to say, but you know, the ability for me to just walk after school and practice until dark was, you know, on any day of the week. I had access to play any day of the week too, if I wanted to. Just, you know, if I wasn't in the competition, I just had to, you know, wait for the competition to go through, and then I could go out. In the major cities that doesn't happen, and kids don't have that access. So I definitely don't think I might have gotten there eventually, but probably not as quickly as I did.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life, all thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Next, a young Carrie Webb takes her talents from small-town Queensland to the big smoke and beyond.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, great to have your company on This Is Your Sporting Life, made possible by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We're with Australian golf legend Carrie Webb. So, Carrie, in your early teens, you start to make the flights to Brisbane for state juniors, and you play your first Australian Junior Championship when you're 14. Can you paint a picture around the culture shock, even just within golf, that greeted you when you got to these bigger city centres?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely was a culture shock. Our tournaments could be played like a 72-hole event. So a four-day event would take 5 days because we'd play Monday, Tuesday. We'd have to have the day off on Wednesday because that was men's day, and then play Thursday, Friday. You know, that sort of thing. Also, my grandma made my golf, or my golf shorts at least, had golf shirts that I bought, my parents bought for me. But, you know, I thought I looked quite smart. But, you know, looking back now, clearly you could probably tell that my shorts were homemade and not bought from a store. And, you could just tell that I was being judged much more harshly because I came from the country than I had been if I'd been more of a refined city kid, playing at city clubs.
So was there any part of you around this time, or maybe you were too young to pick up on it, that felt that you didn't fit into the whole golf image?
I don't think I ever felt that, no. You know, I just always put it down to, you know, the women being old biddies and, you know, being judgmental. And, you know, it didn't really bother me. I mean, I remember one of the clubs I went to, you know, they used to be very strict on the length of your shorts, so much so that they make you get down on your knees and they'd measure from the floor to your hem of your shorts. And if they were short, which mine were about less than a centimeter short, one time they made me unpick the hem of my shorts so that they weren't too short. And so I had to play that day with the hems of my shorts unpicked. And
wow.
Yeah, so that's a better look than having, you know, half a centimeter too short shorts on a 15-year-old kid. You know, like, it's, jeez, like, ridiculous. Yeah. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's those sort of traditions that, you know, I hope are slowly changing and need to be changed in golf.
Some happier memories. Do you remember your first big check?
I do, yeah, vividly, actually. When I turned pro, I actually turned pro sooner than I actually had, you know, set for myself. After I finished school and I didn't have the worries of, you know, studying and catching up on schoolwork and I could play in every event and practice every day. I improved really dramatically in the 2 years after high school, just working part time and then working on my game. That 94, I was, you know, pretty much won everything in Australia, and I was headed to play the World Amateur in Paris, and sort of said to myself, I finished in the top five there, that's against the best amateurs in the world, that that I would turn pro. And I finished fourth, you know, played with the American girl that won it by a million shots, and who actually we went on to play against one another quite a lot once we turned pro. But, you know, so I turned pro with $200 in my bank account. And so I didn't even have enough money to join the ALPG, which it was called at the time, the WPGA Tour. Back then I had to borrow money from my grandparents and my parents to, you know, just make it to the couple of events that they had on the schedule in December of that year. So I went off I went to Adelaide to play the Australian Open. Was my first professional event, and I made the cut. So I made a check, but I don't really remember how much for. It was probably for about $1,500 or something. And then the next week was at the Australian Masters at Royal Pines on the Gold Coast there. And I ended up finishing second to Laura Davies that week, and I made $25,000 and just thought I was a millionaire. Like I thought, I'd just go to the ATM machine just to get a printout of what my bank account looked like.
Yeah, that's so, right. So would have I.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's good in a way that I, you know, I felt like a millionaire with 25,000. Like I thought that was enough money to get me around Europe the following year, playing on the European tour without really worrying that, you know, that 25,000 would do it. So I'm glad I believe that. But, you know, deep down, if I'd had any sort of understanding of how much stuff costs, I definitely would have still said that's not enough to get me around unless I make cuts and make money. But from there, I just sort of never really had any money worries after that. Like I went to Europe and got my tour card and played a little bit in the States waiting for the European tour to start. And then, you know, just, you know, was making cuts and making money every week, and got to August of that year and found myself on the 72nd hole of the British Open with a five, six shot lead. And just going, oh my God, I'm going to win the British Open. And, you know, winning that, well, that just changed my life really. And you know, the one thing when I try and help and advise younger girls turning pro is the one thing I can't talk to them about is when you have to make the cut to keep your card or to pay your bills. Or you know, I've been I don't have the struggling touring professional story. I'm very fortunate that golf's been that good to me. That, you know, after I won that tournament, you know, the world opened up.
Yeah, well, you were the youngest ever winner at the time of the British Open. You might still well be, I'm not sure. But and you were named European Rookie of the Year. You qualified for the LPGA Tour as well. So a lot happened in 95. But just the other side of the money is, how do you go about handling that, Kari? I mean, humble beginnings, no one from your family really came from money, and life-changing doesn't quite cut it as a description, I'd imagine. So this is the other side of professional sport. When it's seen to be somewhat meteoric, how do you handle that side of it?
Yeah. My parents obviously had no background in finances, and you know, I was fortunate enough that before I headed to Europe, IMG had signed me out of Australia. So, you know, being with a management company that was global was key. I think, you know, like when I flew to London to play on the European tour, I was met by someone from IMG, you know, later the next year, once I was in the States, I had an agent over there. And if I traveled to Japan, I had someone that met me there. Mm. It just, for someone that was, you know, I was 20 when I went to Europe, and then 21 in the States, it was good for me to have had sort of that. I felt like I wasn't alone, like there was someone, you know, expecting me at the other end of the flight, and not, you know, knowing, you know, especially back then, I'm sounding old, but back then there's no mobile phones or emails or anything. It's just, you're told, you know, such and such is going to meet you at the airport, and then you get there and they're there, you know, you don't have to text them or anything like that. That, yeah, so that was really good. And financially, you know, it was good because they took care of everything. You know, I learned my lesson the hard way that when you're not paying attention to your finances, when it's not, you know, when someone's looking after your money and it's not their money they're looking after, sometimes they don't do the best job. But early on, you know, setting up a house in the US and having all my bills paid and all of that, I mean, I could not have played as good as I did as early in my career if it weren't for that. You know, I've since taken control of a lot more of that part of my life. So, but at the beginning, yeah, I definitely couldn't have done it without the help of IMG and the system that they ran.
Yeah. So 96, I think you claim your first LPGA crown as well. And you're the first LPGA player at the end of 96 to pass the $1 million mark in a single season. So this all means growing up in the public as well, I suppose, Kari. I mean, a lot of the individual sports, tennis, golf, etc., we've unfortunately seen how difficult it can be for some individuals. I'm not saying you were an earlier version of Michelle Wee, of course, but how big was the adjustments to this life for a somewhat shy country girl?
Yeah, definitely was an adjustment. Just the responsibilities, I guess, it was almost playing golf was the easy part. It was, for me, it was the off course stuff that was a lot more challenging for me. You know, and I think I was a shy country girl, but I had a very dry, sarcastic sense of humor. And for anyone that hasn't spent a lot of time in the US, dry sarcasm doesn't go over all that well in the States. There's only a certain few Americans that get dry sarcasm. So, you know, when I'd be asked a stupid question in a press conference, it'd be responded with dry sarcasm, and no one, clearly, I didn't realize at the time, but clearly no one got it, and thought that I was just being a brat and, you know, had no personality and whatever. So I did learn very quickly that you have to say sarcasm with a smile so everyone knows it's a joke.
Yeah. So I guess as a 12, 13-year-old at Air Golf Club, was becoming famous as cool as a younger Kari may have imagined?
I mean, it certainly had its benefits, but it definitely was a lot more overwhelming than I ever would have imagined. And just not, you know, not like going out and not realizing that you might be recognized. I never got caught up in all of it enough to realize that, to know that when I would head out to a restaurant, there's every chance that someone's going to recognize you. So I was always caught off guard by it, you know, like I didn't expect it. And, you know, I don't know. I didn't handle it very well at all early on. You know, and especially if I was out with other golfers and I was the only golfer that was recognized, I was kind of embarrassed that, you know, because I could be out with players, you know, I had quite a few older players that sort of kept an eye on me, and I'd be out with them and they'd actually won more tournaments than me or, you know, were already in the Hall of Fame and they weren't recognized, but I was. And, you know, I just felt that I was embarrassed by that, you know, like you know, I'm looking up to these people. You should know who these people are. So it definitely, that was my biggest learning curve, was understanding how all that worked off the course and I guess really shying away from it more than embracing it. But, you know, I'm glad I did it back then and not now, because with social media, that would have been brutal. Yeah. I couldn't have handled it, I don't think.
Yeah, you wouldn't be on your own there, that's for sure. You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life, brought to you as always by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Just jump online to visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Well, next, Kari Webb tastes major success for the first time.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying this week's edition of This Is Your Sporting Life. We're chatting with Australia's seven-time major winner, Kari Webb. Well, Kari, the first of those seven majors lands in 1999 in Canada. The same year, you named LPGA Tour Player of the Year. But the major itself, did you smell the roses there, celebrate the milestone, or do you move on quickly in professional golf? You know, there's always the next tournament, so to speak.
Well, actually, my mum was over for that one, so I guess I celebrated a little bit. But like most of the early days of my career, it was all right, tick the box, I've done that, what's next? You know, wake up on the Monday and be like, all right, well, that was cool, I won that. So, you know, what are we got to do now to win the next one? But I just think that's a young, ambitious person's mentality. You know, as you get older, you know, you probably should have, relished those moments more and appreciated them more. But I think, if I'd have done that, maybe I wouldn't have gone on to win as much as I did. So, I certainly celebrated them and, you know, took the moment to realize what I was doing, but probably not as much as you would if I was doing it now.
But at least you didn't have to cop the when are you going to win a major question for year upon year.
Yeah, well, and I think it was my 12th major, so it's not like I'd been toiling away for 20 years and hadn't won a major. It was, you know, it was my fourth full season on the LPGA, so it was my 12th major, so you know, it was good. It definitely freed me up after that because and the way I won that major, like I made the cut, I think either on the number or by one. So I hadn't played well Thursday and Friday and then just had a massive weekend to win. So it definitely, you know, got the monkey off my back. And then I played the majors really well the next few years.
Do you now, in fact, ever think back and perhaps now have a greater appreciation of the standard of golf that you were playing around that time and right through until 2001, you know, your best 3 or 4 year block?
Look at this. And how about a birdie finish?
Birdie.
Back-to-back champion at Pine Needles. And in 2001, it is Kari Webb.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely didn't appreciate it at the time. So much so that it wasn't until probably around 2010, I think it was, there was a young Korean girl that was a top 10 machine. She was top 10 week after week. And it wasn't until she got to like 11 top 10s in a row that they said, you know, she's chasing Kari Webb's record of 16 top 10s. I didn't even know I had the record. I didn't know that. And people are like, 16 top 10s. And I'm like, oh my God. And even myself, I was like, I had 16 top 10s in a row. Like, that's crazy. And when players were asking me that, and I said I didn't I didn't even know I had the record. I said, you know what? During that period of time, I was probably complaining that they were just top tens and not as many wins. Yeah. I didn't even care about that record. It was how many wins I was notching up, not how many top tens. So, I definitely didn't appreciate how, I guess, easy the game was coming to me, and how well and how consistently well I was playing.
And golf at that level, Kari, and the ability to soak up pressure. I mean, you snatched victory from the jaws of defeat so many times. Can you put it into words, that the mental game, the mental battle out there?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Up until probably 2003, 2004, that was all natural mental ability. Like, I never worked with a sports psychologist or anything prior to that. That was just all my natural ability to push myself and motivate myself each and every week to squeeze the most of my talent out and leave it on the golf course. And I don't even know. I mean, I know now how I did it, but I didn't have a process that I relied on back then, except for being really hard on myself, I guess. That was my process, was just beating the crap out of myself mentally and, you know, telling myself how much I'd suck, and then I'd go out and prove myself wrong, sort of thing. Definitely not how you would teach anyone to motivate themselves under pressure.
I wanted to ask you about the Battle of Bighorn, actually, which was, for those unfamiliar, a made-for-TV event of 2001, and at the time a pretty fascinating concept, under lights for a portion of it as well, and it was you and David Davalo. I think you'd met for the first time, 2 hours earlier, against Tiger and Annika Sorenstam, and it was a foursome event as well. So Tiger had to deal with Disney, I think, at the time. So easy to say yes to this, great exposure, but it was right hard up against the British Open at the time, wasn't it? In the first year they'd made it a major. So it probably made life a little bit difficult for you on that side of the fence.
Yeah, it definitely did. It's, it was something too. I was still with IMG. All four of us were IMG clients, and it was both men and women world number one and two. I don't really think there was any option for Annika or I to turn it down. And it was great exposure for women's golf. It was the Monday night of our British Open. And we were all the way over in Palm Springs, California. So, they paid for us to fly privately to the UK, but we didn't land till I think it was Tuesday afternoon. So no practice round. Just the pro-am on the Wednesday was our prep for a major, which isn't how you'd normally go in for a major. And, you know, the British Open, I had won the British Open twice up to that point, and it was at Sunningdale where I'd last won the British Open. So, and then it being the first year as a major, it was a big deal, and I love the British Open. And so it was tough on me to choose that, because that really wasn't me. I always chose, you know, to prepare for tournaments the best way I could over anything else. And that's the sort of thing I knew my responsibility was, to promote all of women's golf by playing in that. And I really, really wish it had have been at a different time. I think I would have, I mean, I did enjoy the experience, obviously. It's never been done since. I would have enjoyed it more had it not been the Monday night of the British Open.
Is there a difference between a male crowd and a female crowd?
That was the biggest shock for me, was, I'd played a few years earlier, 96, and I was in the same group as Tiger that year as well. Just the men's crowds are they're so much louder, but just with the heckling and, we don't have that sort of crowd that follows us. So they're a lot more respectful of our game and us as human beings, I guess. When we were playing that match, David and I were, I think we were one up with three to play, and we walked onto 16 green, and a group of people in the crowd started chanting, "Three putt, three putt, three putt." I couldn't believe it. Which, of course, we went on to three putt, so it was perfect. and then we lost the match on the last hole. So, I mean, it was a great experience. It actually showed me how how great mentally the guys are, because they have to deal with so much more when they're out there, and block out so much more than we ever have to do.
Your 2002 British Open win meant you'd completed what was called the Super Career Grand Slam, so every available major championship in women's golf, and you're absolutely flying. But, Kari, then you go through a slump in the three or so years that follow. How do you reflect on that period of your career?
Yeah, it was a slump by my standards, yep, for sure, but it wasn't. I mean, I was still winning. I just wasn't winning majors, and I wasn't, contending for player of the years and stuff like that. I think it was being the world number one and the bright lights on me for literally nearly my whole career. I think it just took a toll on me, and I actually started saying, it'd be good if I was number two or three, you know, like not wanting to be the best, because if I was two or three, there wouldn't be as much focus on me, and I could just go about my life, and I'd still be winning golf tournaments but not having to deal with as much off course stuff. But once you start setting, or when you're not asking the most of yourself or setting attainable goals, not necessarily attainable goals, but goals that you can reach for and know that you're good enough to reach. And I started lowering that bar. It really affected how I played the game. That all sort of carried over onto the course, and then how hard I was on myself, I think, took a toll on me. I just think I was a little burnt out and not enjoying the game the way I should have.
But 2006 was a renaissance, which we'll come to right after this break. We're talking, of course, to Kari Webb on This Is Your Sporting Life. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. The shot that lives in the memory, and her mission to see women's golf and women's sport grow. All that and more coming up with Kari after this.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
It's been great to have your company here on This Is Your Sporting Life. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Golf icon Kari Webb is our guest today. Kari, do you have a favourite shot? Is there one that lives on with you for all the tournaments, all the years on the pro tour? Is there one shot that lives large in the memory?
Yeah, there certainly is. It's probably not I wouldn't say it's the best shot I've ever hit, but it's probably the most important shot, and possibly, well, definitely the most excited I've ever been after the result. Was on the final hole of the Craft Nabisco, which now has been renamed ANA Inspiration. It's our first major of the year, and in 2006. I'd come off, 2005 was the first year on the LPGA Tour that I hadn't won a tournament. And so I came into that week not with the highest of confidence of myself, but anyway, I found myself on the last hole. I think I was two or three groups ahead of the leaders, tied for the lead, and I knew I needed to make a birdie to have a chance of a playoff, and it's a par five. I couldn't go for the green and two because I'd missed the fairway. So I'd laid up and I had 116 yards and just hit a beautiful pitching wedge straight at the pin. And a couple of bounces after it landed, it rolled into the hole. So, yeah, all hell broke loose after that. I jumped into my caddy's arms. He had the bag on his back already, and I think he could have lifted 10 of me at the time, though. He was about as pumped up as I was, so... yeah, it was just even when I talk about it, I can feel the emotions I felt and how hard my heart was beating, and, just the crowd going crazy. Yeah, it was definitely, the most memorable shot I've ever hit. And as it turned out, because at the time I actually thought I'd hold that to win. And by the time I got into the score tent after, I knew that I only had a one shot lead and there was every chance that there was going to be a playoff. So, you know, I had to get my emotions back down in time to be able to go into a playoff. And fortunately I did, and I birdied the first hole in the playoff to beat Lorena Ochoa.
Kari Webb is the champion. She has won the 2006 Kraft Nabisco title.
And they were great seeds too, because you went and leapt into the water as well.
Yeah, well, that's a tradition at that event. The winner jumps into the lake that surrounds the green. And yeah, it definitely I definitely jumped pretty high going into the lake. I've never enjoyed a win more than that one.
I was just going to say, the satisfaction that must have come with that, because as we said, by your standards, a lean run in the couple of years prior, and you did go on, you franked that, you went on to claim four other titles in 2006 as well. I mean, how satisfying was that whole year, given what you'd sort of, as we said, just been through in the years prior?
Yeah, well, that really kick-started the year. I think it sort of freed me up, you know, by that stage, I'd gotten to the point where I knew I needed to really appreciate the wins, you know, and I understood that there's such a fine line between being the best player in the world and not winning a tournament at all, you know, and I never realized that I walked on the good side of the fine line for so long, you know, when you're on the other side of it and you're close, and, you know, you're not getting the results you want, and then all of a sudden you do. I think it really makes you appreciate those times, and I had a lot of friends in town, and we had rented a house, and my caddy was staying with a bunch of caddies in another house, and we went over there, and it was a scene from The Hangover the next day. Like, the house was trashed, absolutely trashed, so much so that because they were supposed to check out of the house, and they called the owner of the house to say, can we have it for one more night, and dropped my name. So then the next year when I went to rent a house, no one had rent it to me because my name had been dropped on the house the year before. And I'm like, that wasn't me. I'm like, it was me, but I didn't rent that house. Yeah.
Fantastic. I guess to the here and now more so, women's sport and the ongoing fight, I guess, to see it reach a status that is, you know, more comparable with the men. This is something that's close to your heart. How passionate are you about this?
I'm really passionate about it. Just more just to, for the growth of the game, you know, to get more young girls into the game. You know, and enjoying the game. You know, it's a sport that you can play your whole life. So even if it's not something that young girls, you know, they might give up for a few years, you know, maybe when they go to university or when they get married and start having kids. But if you get them in the game young and they like it, you know that they'll come back to it. And that's really where the health of our sport lies, is encouraging and young girls and boys, the younger generation, to enjoy the game and make them feel welcome when they're out at the clubs. And it's really about changing the culture and the stereotypes that people think of when they think about golf. You know, and I think it is definitely becoming more diverse. It's just the sum of the examples in recent years, like, you know, that Donald Trump plays golf, you know, that it's a rich white man sport. You know, that hasn't helped our sport. But, you know, it definitely, if you grow up in the town of Ayr, it's not a rich white man sport. It's a game for everyone. And I think it can be everywhere.
How would you, Kari, describe the relationship between the game and its female stars at the moment?
I think it ebbs and flows. I think, we've got a ton of young, great young girls, women, you know, representing us at the highest level. And even within Australia, you know, I've had my series, Kari Webb series, which is a scholarship to the top two young amateurs in Australia. You know, that, I think that, well, for me, it's gone a long way. I think it's developed a community for the, I mean, the Aussies always stick together overseas, but you know, the fact that when these girls come over as amateurs and they meet the Aussies that are already on tour, I think it's less daunting for them to come out on tour. And we've seen in recent years with the likes of Hannah Green and MNG Lee and Sue Oh, you know, playing well over there, and you know, Hannah winning a major a couple of years ago. You know, it's important. I think in Australia, the landscape for women's sports changed so much in the last 5 years. And golf's really got to keep up there. You know, we've got to get these faces out there so the young girls know that, you know, golf's a sport, and there's young women that they can look up to, and aspire to be like, or even just play the sport because of those people. You know, I think, you know, we have to be better as a sport in getting those stories out there and creating those, you know, those role models for young girls and young boys.
Yeah, and you play a huge role here because it's that see it, believe it thinking, isn't it? You've set the path for others to follow. And I wanted to ask about the Curry Webb series as an extension of that. I just wonder your motivation, I guess, as much as anything. Do you feel you have a responsibility for the game of golf going forward?
I do. I think I'm one of the very fortunate few that golf's been as good as it has been to me. And, you know, I just, with the Curry Webb series, you know, that's obviously on the high performance end. And, you know, I just want any young girl that aspires to try and make a living playing golf to get as much out of it as I have, you know, whatever their ambitions or goals may be. You know, if I can, I think when we started it, I didn't really know if I had anything to offer, you know, and it isn't until, you know, the first two or three girls come over and, you know, they start asking you all these questions that you know that you do have this wealth of experience that they can draw upon to hopefully help them progress with their careers.
Curry Webb, it's been awesome to catch up today. I mean, you're one of the greatest players in the history of women's golf. And to be frank, your list of honours runs a little too long for this program. You're an Australian sporting legend, not just because you reached the top of a highly competitive international sport, of course, but because you're invested in making it better for the next generation. Well done on all you've achieved. And thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for letting me talk about some of the great memories.
And thank you for joining us also. You've been listening to This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Jump online to find tobinbrothers.com.au and we'll catch you the next time we celebrate the life of another sporting icon.